Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine you've lived with a secure, recognized legal status for years, maybe even decades. And then in one definitive ruling, a court clarifies a single word in a major piece of law, and suddenly that security just fankered. It fractures. That is the essence of the complex, profound, and often distressing fallout we're diving into today. The UK Supreme Court ruling in For Women Scotland, LTDV, the Scottish Ministers, or the FWS case, which dropped in April 2025.
It's an absolutely crucial deep dive for you, our listener, because this wasn't just some dusty, constitutional matter. This was a highly technical ruling that clarified the meaning of sex in the Equality Act 2010, and that one clarification created an immediate organizational crisis and, a deep personal crisis for thousands of transgender people across the UK.
Exactly. Our mission today is to understand why. Why did this one technical legal interpretation cause such a huge divergence in rights? And what does it now demand of every employer, every service provider, and every leader in the country? So what was the core finding?
The courts stuck to the standard legal approach, really. They looked at how to interpret statutes, and they ruled that sex in the Equality Act 2010 means biological sex. What's so fascinating is how much chaos resulted from what is, on the surface, a simple, conventional legal clarification.
And for people who had transitioned in good faith.
For them, it felt like an immediate withdrawal of legal security. It essentially said, look, when it comes to equality and anti-discrimination law, your identity, which we recognize everywhere else, might not be the operative factor here.
I found the account of Joanne Lockwood so powerful on this. She watched the judgment live, and she said that for her and thousands of other trans people, the ruling just felt like a punch to the gut. It signaled that the law was suddenly defining them sometimes by the sex they were assigned at birth. And specifically in contexts that really matter, like representation, equal pay comparisons, and critically, safety under the Equality Act.
And that punch to the gut is rooted in this immediate real-world divergence the ruling engineered. To explain it simply for you, the Gender Recognition Act 2004, the GRA, that still works. If you have a gender recognition certificate, a GRC, you are recognized as your acquired gender for major parts of your life: marriage, pensions, inheritance. Think of the GRC as a sort of passport. It grants you legal recognition.
Okay, so the passport is fine. Where does the FWS ruling come in then?
The FWS ruling, by focusing specifically on the Equality Act, basically installed a new, a visa requirement, but just for one specific country, the country of anti-discrimination law. It said that for the purposes of the Equality Act, that definition remains rooted in biological sex. So this means for individuals who have that GRC, who have lived as their acquired gender for years, people like our persona, Alexis, their previously secure legal status is now up for reassessment in these core equality contexts. It just shatters their confidence in the law.
It's the constant need for justification that is so corrosive to a person's dignity, isn't it? When the law becomes ambiguous like that, the burden falls entirely on the individual.
Completely.
And inclusion isn't some grand abstract concept stored away in a legal vault. Commentary from groups working in this area points out that inclusion lives in toilets, in job descriptions, in meeting invites. It lives in hospital wards, customer forms, and locker rooms.
That's the perfect illustration, because when the legal definitions fracture, it empowers institutional gatekeepers and even bystanders to challenge an individual's presence. The source material shows this environment leads directly to measurable harm. Post-ruling, reports indicated significantly higher rates of trans and even cisgender non-conforming people being stopped or harassed in gendered spaces.
Wait, hold on. Higher rates for cisgender people, too. How does that happen? How does a ruling about the definition of sex in the EA 2010 end up affecting someone who is biologically female and identifies as female?
It's a crucial insight into how these perceived policy signals trickle down. Staff, or just bystanders, felt newly licensed to enforce a very rigid, visible idea of what a woman or a man should look like. And this practice inadvertently catches people who don't conform to traditional gender stereotypes. So specifically, butch or masculine-presenting cis women, they become collateral damage, harassed based purely on their appearance by people who feel the law has given them permission to challenge anyone who looks like they don't belong.
That is a powerful mechanism of harm that radiates far beyond the initial target group. It sounds like the law inadvertently created a social license for, well, for vigilantism based on appearance.
Exactly. It converts legal ambiguity into day-to-day gatekeeping and discrimination.
Okay, so let's shift our gaze outward for a moment. This wasn't just an internal UK legal headache. Legal experts immediately raised alarms that this domestic ruling threatened the UK's international legal standing. How does a UK Supreme Court ruling on a domestic act end up jeopardizing international law?
The primary concern relates to what analysis of the judgment called a significant judicial omission regarding human rights. So the Supreme Court, well, they use conventional legal methods to conclude sex was biological sex. But here's the problem. The court did not substantively address or analyze the consistency of this interpretation with trans people's human rights, specifically their rights under the European Convention on Human Rights, the ECHR.
And the ECHR is the standard bearer here, correct? It links gender identity directly to Article 8, the right to privacy and family life and human dignity. It actually requires states to implement legal recognition of gender change. So that's critical context.
Absolutely. And we know that influential organizations like Amnesty International UK submitted strong arguments against the biological interpretation, precisely on those human rights grounds. But what happened? Those submissions were acknowledged in only a single sentence in the entire judgment.
A single sentence?
Paragraph 34. They were simply noted, not addressed in any substance.
So the court acknowledged the human rights arguments existed, but then essentially declined to perform the balancing exercise. The exercise required to ensure the biological definition didn't conflict with fundamental rights like privacy and dignity. That sounds like a constitutional time bomb.
It is viewed that way by many legal scholars. This judicial silence creates a massive constitutional risk. And legal critics argue that this ruling risks placing trans people in a worse position regarding single-sex services than they were even before the Gender Recognition Act of 2004. Yeah. Think about that for a second, that historical reversal.
That's astonishing. If the whole point of the GRA was to integrate identity into the law, this ruling essentially uses the Equality Act to undermine that very integration.
Precisely. By failing to reconcile the biological sex interpretation with ECHR rights, the ruling is seen as potentially inconsistent with the convention. This places trans people in an intermediate zone where their identity is legally contested and their protections are, well, ambiguous. The risk is serious enough that analysis stated the ruling has jeopardized the UK's compliance with the European Convention on Human Rights.
When the UK's compliance is jeopardized, what does that mean in practice? Does the ruling get struck down immediately, or does it lead to international scrutiny down the line?
It means increased scrutiny and the potential for future challenges at the European Court of Human Rights. It forces the UK government to either justify the law's current state, or, more likely, it prompts Parliament to eventually legislate a solution to close the conflict. Right now, it's a policy mess because the courts didn't provide the reconciliation, they just defined the word.
Let's move to the people actually caught in the middle of this mess. The employers, the service providers, the organizational leaders, what the law calls the duty bearers. If I run a business or a hospital, this ruling didn't say inclusion is suddenly unlawful, did it? But it made my job monumentally harder.
Monumentally harder is an understatement. If you're an HR director in the UK right now, you must feel like you need a full-time constitutional lawyer on staff just to decide who gets to use the office bathroom or how to write a fair job description. The ruling did not make inclusion illegal. It simply made compliance, protection, and documentation more complex.
How so? Where does that complexity come from?
It stems from the demanding new requirements for proportionality and justification. The Equality Act has specific exceptions under Schedule 3 that allow single-sex services to restrict access. Now, the exclusion of trans people from these services is not mandatory. But if an organization chooses exclusion, or even chooses inclusion, it must be able to prove that the decision is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. And they have to prove it with a documented equality impact assessments, or EOAAs.
So no more casual policy setting. You can't just say, well, we decided this based on how we feel. You have to show your homework, essentially.
Exactly. You must prove with evidence that your decision is the least restrictive means available to achieve your aim. Whether that aim is privacy, safety, or dignity, it shifts the burden of proof entirely onto the organization. You have to document why you made the decision. And that documentation has to hold up against a potential tribunal challenge.
A challenge from either side?
From either a trans person or a person holding a gender-critical belief. Yes.
And this tightrope walk becomes utterly precarious when dealing with intersectional identities that challenge that simple biological sex binary. Let's look at the specific challenge of intersex people.
The focus on a rigid definition of biological sex immediately impacts individuals with intersex variations. Consider our persona, Rosa. Rosa may have been assigned female at birth and lived as a woman her entire life, but she might possess different chromosomes or variations in reproductive anatomy that don't fit the standard binary. Under a rigid biological sex standard, Rosa now faces vulnerability to being reclassified, questioned, or excluded from women's services and records.
That is a staggering invasion of privacy and a huge threat to dignity. It forces individuals to expose private medical information just to defend their presence in a space. Based on a definition of sex that is already complex and, well, non-binary in biological reality.
It shatters their privacy and can lead to immediate discrimination. And this also extends to facilities access for trans people who are early in their transition or who choose not to get a GRC. Take two examples from the material, Danica and Jaden.
Okay, walk us through those two scenarios.
So for Danica, a trans woman without a GRC, her legal sex under this new FWS interpretation remains male in the context of the Equality Act. So exclusion from women's facilities is lawful if the organization can prove it is proportionate. They have to do that EQIA. However, if the service just adopts a blanket denial policy, say denying access to a changing room to someone in early transition like Jaden, who may look visibly nonconforming, that blanket denial may breach Jaden's ECHR Article 8 rights.
Why is that an Article 8 breach specifically?
Because forcing Jaden to use a facility inconsistent with their lived gender identity or to use some isolated separate facility, it could lead to a public outing, severe distress, or humiliation. And those are invasions of privacy and dignity protected under human rights law. The organization has to prove its exclusion is the least restrictive way to achieve its goal. If installing a lock on a single occupancy toilet achieves the safety aim, they can't justify blanket exclusion from all gendered spaces.
So this means organizations are facing tribunal risk from two entirely different directions. And the only way to mitigate that risk is through robust, meticulous documentation and transparency.
Absolutely. The immediate advice that circulated to leaders was clear. You don't have to pick a side. You have to uphold the law, which means demonstrating proportionality. And you have to lead with empathy, which means upholding dignity. The biggest risk is organizational silence, what legal experts call policy recall by silence. If you don't proactively document your proportional decision-making process, any policy you have for inclusion or exclusion looks arbitrary and leaves you legally vulnerable.
So to summarize this deep dive then, the FWS ruling successfully clarified the technical definition of sex in the Equality Act. But in doing so, it amplified a profound structural conflict between two protected characteristics, sex being biological and gender reassignment being identity. So organizations are now forced to operate in the gap between the two, balancing potentially conflicting rights without holding that one has automatic priority over the other.
That's the tension. The law now demands that inclusion or justified exclusion, it can't be vague or assumed anymore. It must be grounded in defensible, evidence-based practice. This isn't just about good management. It requires courageous, evidence-based, human-centered leadership to navigate this mess of conflicting legal standards.
And that leads to a final thought for you, our listener. If the underlying purpose of the Gender Recognition Act was to align the legal position with social and psychological reality, and the FWS ruling has now fractured that alignment for thousands of individuals, we have to look beyond the courts for a solution. What practical legislative steps beyond judicial interpretation must Parliament now take to resolve this inherent profound conflict? The conflict between protecting the dignity of transgender people and upholding the exceptions defined by biological sex. That fundamental question about how law truly reflects identity remains the most pressing unresolved issue of the post-FWS era.